This tape about alcoholism is intended for use by AA members only. Please respect our tradition of anonymity at the public level. Thank you.
Tonight is really a wonderful privilege for me. Ordinarily, our host group chairman, chairperson, announces our speaker, but our speaker tonight is a special girl to me. I love her very much. She has a wonderful message. I don't know what else I can say, Edie. Our speaker tonight is Edie C. from Sacramento!
Hi, everybody. My name's Edie, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, what they do with the speakers from out of town is they take them to dinner, and so they took me to dinner, too. And I was sitting next to this lady from Traditional Genie for about an hour, and she looked over at Patty and said, "Who's the speaker tonight?" And she goes, "We've been sitting next to her for an hour," and she goes, "Well, she's from Sacramento. I've at least gone to Auburn. I've been there. I drank there. You know, I'm so damn nervous, I don't know if I'm going to have diarrhea or puke." And Patty prefers that I puke. And Patty usually gets her way. I want to acknowledge all of the birthdays and say happy birthday. And I want to acknowledge all the people that didn't have birthdays that stood up in their first 30 days and their first 90 days and in their first year. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to, you know, in a minute here, you know, my butt's in convulsions. And my hand's shaking, and I know it's going to be spiritual. Because God's getting ready to kick in here any minute. I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to tell you, but there's a lot of people in the room that know me, so I should tell the truth. I was about a year sober, and I heard a lady down in L.A. say, "I'll tell you the truth as soon as I get it past me." I thought, that'll work. So as I tell my story, God, am I ever nervous. You know, it's such an incredible honor and a privilege to be invited to come down and share with you. It really is. You know, I came to Sacramento because I was afraid I was going to die, and I heard a woman by the name of Grady O speak in San Jose. And I got sober in a lot of different places. And, you know, it was kind of like in that progression of my disease that I knew that if I didn't quit, I was going to die. And I heard Grady speak over in San Jose, and she was the first woman I'd ever heard say the F word with such incredible passion. I thought, I don't know where that lady lives, but I know that I could do my fourth step with her. You know, because, you know, I had some deep, dark secrets that, you know, you just didn't want to just tell to just anybody. And down in Modesto, it just seemed like everybody was so prim and proper, I just couldn't find the right lady. And Grady was the right lady for me. You know, it's an honor. You know, Patty called me up. We spoke together up in Reading at a conference in the beginning of this year. And, I remember looking at the brochure, and it was EDC on Friday and Patty K on Saturday. And I thought, I couldn't believe that, you know. I heard Patty speak when 1979 I was in a detox ward, and it was after about 2 weeks they let you out. They put you in a little bus and take you out into the real world. And Patty was the main speaker at a place called First Street Fellowship, and she came there and spoke. And I come from my background, as I get into my life a little bit, and I'll let you know about that. I come from poverty. I come from a lot of poverty. And Patty told a story about how you can tell the difference between a rich Okie and a poor Okie. And, you know, rich Okie's got two mattresses tied to the top of the car. And a not-so-rich Okie's got one. And when she got here, she had none. And I thought that, you know what, I like that lady. And I, you know, when I was, new in the program, I wasn't much welcomed because I was so hostile and angry. I wasn't the kind of person that they much approached, because I wasn't much approachable. But that night I went up there, and Patty, she gave me a big hug, and she told me to keep coming back. and that was in 1979. I'd like to tell you that I got sober in 1979, but I didn't. I wasn't moved that much. It took a lot to move me continuously into sobriety. And it took, you know, I'm not saying it's like, it's that thing about you actually commit your life to being sober. And my last time I ever had anything to drink or anything in my body of any kind was July the 11th, 1983. And for that, I'll be ever grateful. You know, I spoke to my little brother tonight, and I want to give you a message to my little brother. And the message is for, especially for you new people, you brand new people, especially for you men. See, my little brother, he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous back in the late 70s. It was 78 or 1979, I'm not sure. He got out of the VA hospital, and they had him on antabuse, and he said, Edie, they won't let me go to Alcoholics Anonymous without a blood member of my family taking me. Now, I don't know anything about a pre-request to get into Alcoholics Anonymous, so I figure that's a pretty good deal. And his life is a mess. I think I'll take him. So I loaded my little bro. I only drank about a six-pack that night. I was on my best behavior. I was not an alcoholic. I thought I was a drug addict. But it's the funniest thing. When I didn't have drugs, I drank. And when I, you know, it's the damnedest thing. So anyhow, I went to this meeting in Merced, California, and went in there and signed my name. Now, I come from a background of being a ward of the court for most of my life. So I grew up a lot in foster homes and in the welfare system. And being with the alcoholics and the kind of people I grew up with, when they send the sign-in sheet around, I assumed that you turned that into welfare and they gave you some coffee. Now, I don't know how other newcomers think, that's just how I thought. So I signed my name, but I didn't want the social worker who was getting the list. Now, I make up a lot of shit. I don't know about any of you, but I make stuff up. So I didn't want anybody to think that I was an alcoholic, so I signed my name, Edith Frances Cartwright. You know, like a dignitary or something, you know. And you know who the chairperson called on first? Who would you call on first if somebody signed in like that? They called on Edith Frances Cartwright. And, of course, I said to them, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. My little brother here, Shane, he's an alcoholic, just got out of the VA hospital. He's on antabuse, and I want you to know that I am a blood member. I am his sister. I am really a blood member. Well, you know what happened after the meeting? They bombarded me with telephone numbers because, you know, they thought I had a problem. And that created the first resentment I ever had against Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want you to know that in that meeting, I heard a lot of strange things that night. I heard a lot of strange things. I heard people say things that I don't know why you'd say things like that in public. Because I come from a background of, you know, if they know, you know, you don't let them know. Like when you're hurt, you don't let them know you're hurt. And when you're sad, you don't let them know you're sad. And when you're in pain, you don't let them know you're in pain. And there were people saying some pretty intimate things around that table. And, you know, this guy was talking about wearing women's underwear to a job interview and how a sponsor told him he needed to get honest. And I just thought, well, I just couldn't figure it out. But I thought, well, whatever serves him. But I want you to know that night, it's like I think a lot of us, and I can't speak for anybody but for myself, is that there was something that happened in that meeting that made me want more. I wanted more, and I knew that I was an alcoholic. I absolutely knew I was an alcoholic, but I just didn't know how to not drink. Now today, at 3:15, my little brother, he called me. And he called me from Deer Lodge, Montana, in prison. Because my little brother, he's doing 30 years in Deer Lodge, Montana. And he wants all of you to know that if you're new, you don't ever have to do it ever again. And you don't have to have alcohol take you to the places that alcohol will take you when you don't think it'll take you there. And that message is from my brother. And for a long, long time in Deer Lodge, Montana, they didn't have any AA meeting, H&I meetings. But because I get to go all over the country speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous, I kept telling about that bad AA they had up in Montana. I want you to know they had AA in Montana now, in the Deer Lodge, Montana prison, because they just got tired of me talking bad about them. I used to go, I was in Atlanta, Georgia. I said, I don't know what they're doing up in Montana, but they got no H and I. I went to Nashville, Tennessee. I said, I don't know what they're doing in Montana, but they got no H and I. Then it got around that they had no H and I in Montana, and I want you to know, talking straight gets stuff to happen. Yeah, I don't know if that's so. My brother says that that's what's so. I think it's probably God just doing what needs to get done. Now I'm going to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like today, and I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. Because, you know, I was telling Patty, you know, I'm one of those, I think I ought to be the poster child. I think we ought to have poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I tell you, I was one of them crippled guys. There were many times they didn't want to let me in here. And, I know I get moved by thinking about where I come from. You know, I had my first drink. I come from the kind of background they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from seeking lower companionship. I didn't come from people that owned a Buick and worked their way down from a track home. I didn't come from people that put alcohol in a glass with ice cubes and poured it over the top and called it a cocktail. No, I came from people that pulled it out from underneath the seat. My mouth is so dry. And they cranked off the lid, and they took a big swig, and they passed it to whoever else was in the car. And I don't know why this night was any different. I spent the majority of my childhood growing up in old cars, old beat-up cars behind old beat-up bars. And one night I was laying down. After you're in the car a while, they, you know, in 5 or 6 hours of being in cars, they have you lay down so nobody can see you. So I was laying down, and I fell underneath the seat, and I pulled out a bottle of Sigrum 7, and it had about this much in it. And I cranked off the lid, and I kicked it back, and I took my first drink of alcohol. I don't know about any of you, but, you know, when you drink that whiskey, you know, I drank it just like they did. I could never figure out why they would go, you know, until I, you know, it had about this much in it. I drank almost all of it down, and what I did, it's just like, you know, it's like it sucked the wind right out of me, just like, you know, if my ears started to ring, my tear ducts, and I just went, you know. And then I realized why they grunted after they took a big swig of it, because it hurts. It hurts for a little while. Until it does for that magic that I don't think it does it for anybody unless you're an alcoholic of my type and kind. And what it did for me is it burned all the way down until it got to my gut, and then it spread out and went, wah. Wah. You know, that wah. And for the first time in my life, I didn't care about nothing. For the first time in my life, I wasn't ashamed. For the first time in my life, I didn't feel pain. And it was a magic that carried me for a long, long time. And that's what alcohol did for me. It took me to those places where I couldn't go. I had a lot of hate, and I had a lot of anger. You know, when I think about the privilege of being able to come and speak in a meeting of any kind, or even be able to share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think about the fact that my mother, Henrietta Valdez, who never made it to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the way that my mother found an end to her pain as she walked down the hall, she sat on the edge of the bed, and she took a gun, and she shot and killed herself when I was 3 years old. And I was the one that found my mom. You know, I got my nieces living with me. I have a family that's adopted me, and I have brothers and sisters. I got my sister living with me today. And I have two little baby nieces. They're 3.5 years old. They're twins. And they live with their Auntie Edie. And, you know, I get to heal through them. I'm damn near 40 years old. And every time I talk about that, I want you to know it still hurts. But what's happened for me is I get to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I get to heal. And I've healed. And when I came here, I didn't know how to tell you those things. I didn't know how to tell you any of those things. I was the one that was sitting in the corner, and I had so much hostility and hatred, you didn't come next to me. You didn't approach me. you just kept loving me. You just kept loving me, and you kept hugging me, and people like Patty and Grady and Patricia Terry, and, you know, people like that just kept holding on to me. Bob Burton and all those people. There's so many people in this room that were there for me and held me and loved me when I wasn't lovable. You know, there's lots of organizations all over the world like to have what we have, and you know what? You know, they tried to sue somebody in New York. This guy's wife got sober, some highfalutin guy in New York. You ever hear the story about his wife got sober? And she changed. She got different. She got kind of cocky. He tried to, you know, this big highfalutin lawyer, he said he's going to sue Alcoholics Anonymous, screwing up his life. And then they found out that you can't sue nobody because we don't really have a CEO and we just run on love. People show up here and they do all the you know, all the volunteering and everything they do. They don't get no money for that. They do that out of their heart. And we, you know, it's the most wonderful program in the world. And everybody in the world copies us because we're so successful. So if you're, you know, you're new here, there are people that are going to die tonight that not made it to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I believe that if you're in the room tonight, it's because you're chosen. God has a plan for you. You know, I grew up in my childhood. I grew up, after my mom died, I grew up with a woman who was my cousin for about 10 years of my childhood, from the time I was 13 years old. And who she was a woman that'd do anything for a drink. And she took us to places that little kids should not have go. And I seen things that little kids should not have seen. And I learned how to survive. You know, I when they talk about surrendering in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think about a time when we're living in low-income housing in the Fillmore District in San Francisco. And you know how it's all kind of concrete and there's playgrounds there. And you know, you learn to like identify the people because it's sort of like you learn this animal instinct. You just know things. This woman was walking across the courtyard, and I'd been in and out of AA, and they kept talking about surrender and kept talking about surrender. And I think I thought about this time when I was a little kid. I was about 6 or 7 years old, and this big heavyset lady come walking across the courtyard at me, and her nylons were stitching together, and you know. And I could tell by looking at her, she was a social worker or a probation officer, or she was something. She was not a resident of the facility. And when she got up to me, you know what I was doing? I had this big old there's a big old wad of bubble gum on the ground, and I was scraping it up. I had a nickel, and I was scraping it up. And I used to chew gum off the ground. Now, I don't know why I chewed gum off the ground. Probably because somebody told me, don't chew that gum off that ground. I'm the kind of kid, as soon as you tell me I can't, I just have to. And she walked up to me, and she looked down at me, and she said, well, little girl, why don't you take that nickel and buy yourself some gum? And I looked up at that lady, and I said, because I want to chew this gum, that's why. Now, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me I had to surrender to God, you know, I had some problems with that. You know, I was one of those people they referred to as a retread in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would come for a little while, and then I'd leave. And I'd come for a little while, and then I'd leave. I had a friend once tell me if I had a concho belt, if I took all those chips and drill holes in them, I'd have a concho belt go around me twice. And what I want you to know is I really wish it didn't have to be that way. You know, and it was just that way. It was that way. It took a lot for me to get to the point where I could quit. And I had to go to a lot of places that I didn't want to have to go. You know, I was one of those that you know, all those AA, I started, I was telling Patty tonight at the dinner table, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wore Wrangler jeans, flannel shirts, cowboy boots, 2 6-packs of beer, and forget you. Now, I said it nice for Patty because I said I wouldn't use the F word here tonight, but that's who I was when I got to you. And it was really hard for me. You know, I was one of those blackout puking drinkers. And I was like in the program, I kept coming and back and forth. And I got to the point where, you know, didn't you think if you just got, I'll just drink Coors Light. Because that's not really alcohol. You know, it's really not alcohol. And I went one night after work to one of those sleazy bars and went and called the wagon wheel. I love those sleazy-ass bars. Sleazy, the kind you can smell a block off. You know, They never turn on the lights and they never clean up nothing. The beer and everything just kind of mixes together. They play country western on the jukebox and you can sit there and live your life through that music with whoever will listen. And I was there and I was going to control my drinking. And I don't know how far into it, but I went away. I would just go away. You know, you just go away. And my going away at this point was, they'd last 3, 4, 5 hours. And when I woke up and I was in my car with this fairly heavy set man. He was a scary man, actually. And you've been to AA, you know, they tell you those scary stories in AA, and they say, now you don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to go out and get those yet. You can stop now. And, you know, I looked over at that guy, and I want you to know straight up, he looked like a yet to me. He was a yet. You know what? He had on one of those motorcycle vests, leather vest. He had a red bandana. He had tattoos all over the major part of his body that I could see. He had a big old hairy gut that was sitting on his thighs. And I wondered how long we had been sharing time together. You know, there was some movement in the back seat, and I turned around, there was a woman in the pink boob tube with Hail's Angels wings permanently tattooed to her chest. And I said, my, my, my. You know how you have those moments? Any of you been in and out of the program? You just, like, wake up one of those moments, and you just know, oh, my God. Oh, my God. You don't know where you are. You don't know if you've been kidnapped. You don't know if you've said, yes, I'll go. You just know they're driving your car that last you remembered it was registered to you. You don't know if the registration's paid. Probably not, but it's your car. And I knew in that moment that they were those things and those stories they talked about in Alcoholics Anonymous, yet seeking lower companionship, those stories they tell in AA. But what, you know, if you're sort of quick in your head, you know now, you don't turn to these people and say, I'm in the chronic stages of alcoholism. I'm a retread in Alcoholics Anonymous. They tell me that you people could possibly be yets, and I need for you to take me home now. No, you don't do that. I don't know, some of you might. Had I kept drinking, I might have tried that. But I thought, this is what this alcoholic brain cooked up. Well, you got this far. You might as well just tie on a good one. Just get complete with this. Like, just drink all you can drink and do all you need to do and just get done. And then go to that place in AA they talk about called treatment. They used to say to me in AA meetings, Edie, they didn't say, Edie, you should do 90 meetings in 90 days. They said, Edie, we think you ought to go to treatment. Now, that was before they had all the highfalutin fancy treatment facilities. There wasn't any care units or those kinds of things yet. Big business hadn't found out that there was money in recovery yet. The sleazy old TB units is where you went. Back in the old days. But at any rate, I want you to know, I looked at these people, I didn't know what to say, I thought we should break into some sort of conversation. And I said, so, you got a beer? And they said, well, yeah, Edie, you bought beer in Sacramento. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the San Joaquin Valley, but Winton's right out of Atwater, which is right out of Merced, is right out of nowhere, you know. But it's a good 2 hours from Sacramento. So I figured we'd been riding for a while. They said we were going to Reno to purchase some things with my money. And I said, okay. And I want you to know I went on one of those long, drawn-out drunks. And about four or five days later, I woke up. I woke up in somebody's house, and nobody was home. You ever do that? I was sort of relieved. And you know how you know you're in a middle-class environment? You know, you kind of go through the house wondering, well, what kind of people I've been hanging out with. I went in the kitchen, they had pretty good appliances, and they had a trash liner. They had a trash liner in the trash can. I'm going to tell you, only middle-class people that have somewhat not unmanaged their lives still have trash liners in the trash can. Little white liners with little pulleys on them, you know. So I said, well, at least I'm still sort of mucking it up with some stylish folks. But, you know, inside of me, I knew that there was something that had to happen. And I reached in the top pocket of my Wranglers, and I pulled out this number, and her name was Mary. Mary D. in Turlock. And I went to the phone, and I said, Mary, I called her up, and I said, I don't know if you remember me. My name's Edie, and I go to that meeting down there sometimes. She goes, oh, no, I remember you. And I said, well, I've kind of been on one, and if you'll come and get me, I'll go to treatment. And she said, where are you? And I said, I don't know. So I started by the mail, I found the TV guide, and I read the address off of it. Because that's the way my life was. And I was somewhere off in the east part of Modesto. And Mary came, and she picked me up, and she took me to treatment, and I barely remembered the ride there, and don't remember being there, and they said that I woke up 3 days later. That's what I remember. I remember waking up 3 days later. And I think God has a sense of humor because I woke up in the old TB ward in Scenic General Hospital in Modesto called Reality. It's still there. It's still there, and I want you to know, a lot of people I know went through there, and they're still sober. I don't know what it's like when there's just something that happens to you, and you wake up, and you're in reality. Then I was sitting on the couch in an old, I had on sponge slippers. I had on Stanislaus County pajamas stamped all over, Stanislaus County. And I had on a green robe somebody else had worn previous to me and burned holes all in it. I think they were probably smoking them old rolling mill bulldorm smoke cigarettes, you know, and kind of drip all over you and catch shit on fire. Anyway, right there was an old wino next to me on this couch, and the kind of couch it was the kind that you sit down in, somebody has to help you out of. Because the springs are all gone, so I probably donated it down there. And I looked over at this guy, and he's rolling cigarettes, spitting on it way too much, and tearing the paper. And I wasn't feeling real good. And I thought, oh my, God almighty, where have we gotten ourselves now? This looks serious. And I started looking down, and it looks like this is not easily accessible to get out of here. Like, how do you get out of here? So I looked at him and said, well, you know, where are we? He looked at me with hardly any teeth and said, you're in your meat hook. I'm like, oh my God, I still have medical insurance. If you're new in the big book, they refer to that. You know, I looked around, I said, oh, I obviously can get better facilities than this. I couldn't get over those things they had stretched over my feet. I played with them for 45 minutes. That goes to tell you what kind of shape this girl was in. I just one size fits all. I just couldn't figure it out. Just stretch forever, you know, just. And I thought, well, I worked in a union. When I got out of high school, I joined the carpenters union because I couldn't spell and I couldn't type, and I figured I'm a hard worker. And that's really what it was. It wasn't out of any desire to be some trailblazer or anything. It was just out of thinking I was stupid. But at any rate, I want you to know, I went through the carpenters union, and in 1979, I became a full-fed, dirt-level carpenter. And because of that, I had Blue Shield health insurance. And drinking's acceptable in the construction industry, you know, it really is. And so I sort of went through my life and decided, well, you still have Blue Shield, and you need to go someplace better than this. This is a hell of a place to end up if you're going to, like, do something serious. So I want to know that I pulled myself together. You know, we get in those situations, but, you know, we try to make the best of it. You know, I got all stood up and did the best I could with that Stanislaus County pajamas and robe, and I pulled myself together. And there was a, in the middle of the detox ward there, in reality, there's a little person that is assigned to watch us. And you go over there and you knock on the glass, and they'll buzz you in. And you sort of get in the drift of where I, what kind of place I was. But it's amazing the grandiosity that lives inside the alcoholic mind. I got in there, and there's a man there. I want you to know that man saved my life. His name was Hank Bagby. And he was an old cocaine addict, alcoholic, who'd been clean and sober for 14 years. I told old Hank my tale of woe. You don't understand. I've got a job. I got a car. I've got a company vehicle. There has been a grave mistake. And I started telling him, and you know, he just sat there and he listened. I had such a story about it. You know, I grew up with alcoholics. This is an alcoholic. Yes, this is, yeah, this is what it is. It's for alcoholics. I said, well, you don't understand. I'm not that bad of an alcoholic. I got a lot of problems, and I'm having a little bit of bad run of luck here. Not quite sure how I got here, but you don't understand. And he just nodded. And he listened to me tell my story. You know, he never once interrupted me. And when I was done, he looked at me and he said, honey, you've been with us for 3 days, and you're in the chronic stages of alcoholism. He goes, and I can give you your clothes, and you can go back out there. But I want you to know that you're going to die, and that you're not well. And if anything's going to help you, if you need to go in there and you get on your knees and beg God for help, because you're one of those that are so hurt and so wounded and so angry, I don't know if any human being will ever be able to touch you again. And I don't know why, but for some reason, I hurt him. You know, I knew that there was really something wrong with my life. But it was like to acknowledge that I was an alcoholic was the hardest thing for me to do. You know that woman that I grew up with after my mom died? I want you to know that she was just an old street whore. And she'd do anything. She'd do really bad things in a front seat of an old car for a bottle of Thunderbird. And I said, I'd never do that. I watched her when, just before she died, we were living in Watsonville, California, in a little hotel above one of those little sleazy bars and over where the transients work. And by now she's out there working the transit camps, doing the labor camps. And in the morning when she'd get up, she'd drink off a big old bottle of Carlo Rossi wine, and she'd puke all over herself, and I'd clean her up. And she'd drink off that bottle, and she'd get sick, and I'd clean her up. And see, in my mind, that's what a woman alcoholic looked like. A woman alcoholic was somebody that would have to sit in their own puke and drink off a bottle of wine, and I just could not begin to acknowledge that that's who I was, that I was a woman alcoholic. See, I thought you had to go there. And I didn't really know what an alcoholic was. I knew that I grew up with people that were really messed up and did a lot of strange things, but I didn't really know they were alcoholics. I just knew they drank a lot, and we didn't eat right, and we kind of did crazy things, and in the middle of the night, they would come after the bar would close, and they'd go down the street carrying all the cars as they drove down. You know, I just knew there was something wrong in my family. I didn't know what it was, but God, there was something really off there. So when he told me I had to admit that I was an alcoholic, I just didn't know how to begin to do that. And I want you to know that I went into the shower stall in reality, and I got down on my knees, and I asked God to help me. For the first time in my life, I said, God, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know I don't want to die like the rest of the people in my family. And I know that I'm just running some kind of story on myself, thinking that I am. And I want you to know that I went through the 28-day program of reality, and after 48 days, they said, Edie, you got to go now. You know, it's funny, when you finally surrender, you just say, well, just let do the floors, you know. It's like the thought of going out there in life and trying to do life was the most overwhelming thing for me to deal with, you know? And you know what I did is I used to go at Modesto when I got out of treatment, I used to go hang out at First Street Fellowship, and an old man by the name of Earl saved my life. You know, I had such low self-esteem. All I would do is, man, First Street Fellowship was a place about as big as this, but it was all corrugated metal on the outside, and it was on the poor side of town, and when it was cold in the winter, you could feel the air just blow through First Street. And they had a big old gas stove in the middle, and then they had another one over there. It was kind of a sleazy little place, First Street was. And it had a bunch of couches, and Earl come every morning at 6 o'clock, and he opened it up at 6, and he closed it at 12 night at night, and he played pinochle all day long. That's what he did. He just played pinochle. And I would go there at First Street Fellowship, and I'd just sit on the couches and read magazines and read the paper and just sit there and watch him play pinochle. And then Earl started noticing me. I came fairly regular. Never went to the meeting in the corner, because they had a big table over there and had an AA meeting in the corner, and I never went over there. And Earl used to say to me, "There's a meeting in the corner. There's a meeting in the corner." And I don't think I even acknowledged he was talking to me. And after a while, I don't know how long we did that back and forth, and he said, "Well, if you're not going to go to the meeting, why don't you go in the kitchen, wash some cups?" And somebody had given them, you know those big old white cups, those old thick white cups that restaurants used to have, those big white ones that get chips in them and get kind of dirty? They had about 200 of those cups. I want to tell you what, I went down to the market and got me some Comet and bleach, and I scrubbed the hell out of those cups. Those are the best, cleanest cups you've ever seen in your life. Pretty soon I painted the kitchen. I got to the point where I wouldn't go to the AA meeting, but I just waved. You didn't drink your coffee fast, so I took your cup and washed it. I'd snag it. Then I went down to the strip store and I got me some curtains for First Street, kind of dress it up a little bit. You know, got to clean this place up. Hell, it's going to be my home. We might as well make it livable. And pretty soon I want you to know that I could sit around the table. See, I had to earn my spot to sit at the table because I had such self-hatred. I didn't think I was worthy enough. And that's been my way in life. I had to do and do and do just so I could be here. And after I scrubbed those cups and they knew I was the best cup scrubber and they used to always talk to me about, "You do such a good job with those cups, glory God." I became a part of that group, you know, and about 2 years ago, Earl, he died. Earl died with somebody who had less than 30 days sobriety in his arms at First Street Fellowship. He died of a heart attack right there at First Street Fellowship. They'd moved and they're in a new place. But I want you to know it was people like Earl that saved my life. I don't know if that old man hadn't talked so crotchety to me and told me to go wash cups, I'd have done that. Had I not done that, I can't tell you that I'd actually be here with you tonight. Washing those old cups gave me my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know it sounds stupid, but if you're new and you want to figure out how to become a part around here, why don't you just find the cups? Now, they don't have the cups, go buy some at the thrift store and go wash them up. I think we spend too much money on these styrofoam non-things anyhow. There's something about that old AA and those real cups that gives you something to do when you just don't know what to do, you know. God, shouldn't, what do you want me to do, sit around there and say something? God almighty, I'd rather die. And that began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved to Sacramento and Grady was my sponsor, and I was a member of Primary Purpose right over there in 12th and I above the Trailways bus stations. And, you know, I don't know what we did at Primary Purpose, but there's a lot of people still sober that walked up those stairs. You know, and every Thursday night, you had to be there. If you were new, they just pretty much told you that if your opinion, you had an opinion, they'd rather you keep it to yourself. They talked mean to you back then. And every Thursday night, we got down in the women's restroom. We did a third-step prayer with all the new women that came that day. You know, Grady and Patricia and Gwen, and they'd get us all down on our knees, and we'd do the third-step prayer with whoever was new. And if there wasn't anybody new, we just said a prayer for the newest one there. And those are the things that began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I came and asked Grady to be my sponsor, and she says, "Well, how long sober are you?" Well, hell, I didn't really know, and I don't know about any of you, but I had a little bit of trouble with the truth. And I was afraid if I didn't have any time, she wouldn't be my sponsor, so I said I had 6 months. It was even. You know, it cracks me up. You go to the doctor. Even today, you talk about honesty in the program. You know, any of you go to the doctor, they say, "Doc, can be right with you?" I just went. I just had to go. I had to go get some things checked out. I was always medical center at the cancer clinic over there, and they put me in. They have, you know, they got nice cabinets. Now, how many of you, I swear to God, sit in there and think about that? They got those nice nonstick band-aids. You know, what the hell? A couple of those won't bother anything. Now, I'm a long time sober. I don't take the band-aids today, but it isn't that I don't think about it. The difference today is I don't take the band-aids, so I have to go back later and make amends for, well, you know, I took them band-aids. I say that the recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, you do your fourth step in order to complete the past. It's like we get here and all we have is our past. And it's, you know, I learned in the last year or so is that my past is all I had. It's like my past was misfiled in my future, and that's all I had to live into was my past. That was it. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous by doing the fourth step, you complete your past. You get rid of all that. And so you take your past and you put it back in the past, and then you have the future that you can live into. You know, you create a future unlike anything that's unrecognizable from what you brought here, which was your past. When they talk about our stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, all I'm telling you about right now is my past. You know, that's it. And that's who I brought. You know who I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous? I brought a little half-breed Mexican that nobody wanted. It was broken. You know that big wad of gum I'm just scraping up off the ground? You know that lady happened to be a I don't know who she worked for, but she just fell in love with me. You know, she went and found the lady that I live with, and she came down to the playground there that day after we went through that. Remember that scraping the wad of gum and the fat lady? Remember that story? Yeah. Okay, good. That's good. I wanted to make sure you remember it because it's important. And what happened is that lady had all my belongings in a Safeway suitcase, and she took me home. She took me home. And I remember driving across the Bay Bridge with that lady thinking, I don't even have the value of a bag of potatoes. They just gave me away. And so I hurt. And when I got to you, that's who I brought. I brought that little girl they would give away to somebody they didn't know. And the only reason I can tell you that they came and got me back was they couldn't get any money if I wasn't there. So that's where I lived from when I came to you. That's who I brought. Anytime I walked into a room or, you know, you go for a job interview or anything, who you take is your past. So what you do with your fourth step is first, you know, you admitted you were powerless over alcohol and that you keep doing the same thing, which is insanity, and you ask God to relieve you of that, which is step two. And then you say, I just can't do this anymore, and you turn your life over to God. And what you do in step four is you complete your past. You know, who's ever telling you in this room that a four step is hard, you need to get rid of them. You need to get rid of them. I don't know who they are, and I hope they're not real close to you, but if they're telling you a four step's hard, then you need not hang out with them. And really, it's only my opinion. But it's very important that you know that if you think it's hard, it's because all you want to do is hang on to the past. You take all those resentments and you write them down on a piece of paper. And you complete it. You get it all out. At the top of the page, you say, God, free me from my past so I can go on with my future. Because I want a life unlike I've had with what I brought here. And I want you to know that people in Alcoholics Anonymous have helped me do that. And I've gone out and I've found other help. And today, my life is unrecognizable from who Edie brought through the door. You know, when I was 3 years sober, I was over at Group 3 whining because I said I was self-employed. I wasn't self-employed. I was just unemployable. Uncoachable, couldn't tell me anything. I couldn't go to work and get a job because I couldn't get up. But I made a lot of noon meetings talking about the potential I had. Hell, I had a lot of potential. I just couldn't quite tap into it. It was there. It's like a reservoir of oil. You just got to get to it. And there was a guy walked up to me and he said, you know, the state of California is hiring building inspectors. The state architect's hiring building inspectors. Why don't you go, you know, get on the list, maybe take a test and get a job? You know what? I want you to know that I didn't know how to write a resume. There's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that helped me write a resume. There's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that helped me fill out the state form and the job application. and it was people in Alcoholics Anonymous that drove me down to the place where you turn it in. And I turned it in. And I got a test date, and I want you to know that it was people in Alcoholics Anonymous that drove me to the community center the day that I had to take a test. It was people in Alcoholics Anonymous that walked me to the door of the community center, opened the door, and said, "Now go on in there, take the test." And I did, and I took the test, and I want you to know that I got 85% on a 4.5-hour test, and I was hired by the state architect's office as the first woman to ever do industrial inspections in the state of California. It had nothing to do with me, because who Edie brought to Alcoholics Anonymous was a little wetback half-breed nobody wanted to give away to some fat lady who wore nylons that scrubbed them together and sent her across the Bay Bridge to just give her away. Do you understand how that past just keeps going? But it's people in Alcoholics Anonymous, like it says in the Keys to the Kingdom, that if you are willing to do the work that needs to be done, and you work the steps, and you get a sponsor, and you show up, and you do the things that they ask you to do, your life will be altered, unrecognizable from what it was before you got here. So those people in Alcoholics Anonymous pushed me through that door. It was people in Alcoholics Anonymous that packed my truck, my little beat-up truck, and packed me up and sent me down to San Diego, California for my first job with the state of California. And I want you to know it was the hardest thing I ever did to leave here and go down there and show up on that job. I showed up on that job and I was scared to death. I was scared to death. I live in a little trailer house on Mission Bay. I was scared to death. I was scared to death that maybe I just somehow answered the questions but didn't really know the answers. You know what I'm saying? It's just like you walk onto the job thinking, oh my God, I wonder if I really know anything, you know? And I want you to know, my first day on the job was a really painful day. You know, I know it would be kind of surprising to you, but I ran into a little resistance. And I'm going to tell you about the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got, they put me in a car with an old guy, an old inspector, been 28 years with the state. He's the kind of guy who wore his hard hat in the inside of the car. He was a serious, you know, he reduced the zone book down to his back pocket. You know what I'm talking about? That kind of guy. So we're driving down. It's a 900-acre prison site. They're building a new prison down there, and me and old Al was hard hat on inside the car. He looked at me and said, "Well, I knew the minorities were going to get here, just didn't know when." Well, you know, it's like there's people like Patty Kay and Patricia Cherry and people like that in my life. And see, there's many things I thought about saying in that moment, but I didn't. I just looked at him and thought, well, we'll make a little dull conversation. I'll just pretend like he was that fat guy I woke up with that time I was in. I'll say, "Well, what other minorities are coming besides me? Because I know I'm one. I'm, you know, brown-skinned female. I'm a affirmative action hire," he thought. Found out later I actually scored higher on the test than the old stupid fart had himself. He looked at me. "Now, I'm not. Now, Patty, now you just cover your ears. Now, I'm going to say some things you might want to hear, but it's very important you get the essence of old Al." Al looked over at me and says, "Well, we knew we had two niggers, an Indian, and a C coming." I can't say it in front of you, I swear to God. Yeah, but you know your imagination, you fill it in. So I just have too much respect to say. I've said it all over the country, but I just can't say it here. Now, I want you to know that everything in me had some things that I wanted to say that to that man. But because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who's respectful and dignified, I looked at him and I said, "I realize you must have some resistance in my being here." This is where you act as if. And I said, "But it's not okay for you to ever speak to me like that, ever, ever, ever again." And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, because see, who came to Alcoholics Anonymous was a little junkyard dog that could have told that man a piece of her mind. And I want you to know that that day something shifted for me. See, you just don't have to fight and be ugly. And the bottom line is, I know that old boy really didn't mean me no harm. He really didn't. He just didn't know any better because he'd been taught that way. And I stayed on that job for a year and a half, and I want you to know that I lost 14 pounds, and when I left there, I was puking blood because it wasn't pretty. The second day I was on that job, there was a coffee can on my desk. It said, donations for penis transplant in Tijuana. There was $6 in the can. I don't know if you can buy a penis in Tijuana for $6. But I didn't go shopping. But I'll tell you where I lived in San Diego. I lived in H&I meetings, and I lived in the jails, and I lived in AA. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and I never had to say ugly things or get nasty to any of those people that treated me that way. And there's something in there that's called healing. See, I could have done the way I was in the past, and what would that have created? You know, I came up to the Spring Fling. They invited me to come to the Spring Fling and be a 15-minute speaker. And I came up to the Spring Fling, and I read the paper, the Sunday paper, and there was a job out at UC Davis. And I, again, people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they helped me put a resume together, and they put an application together. And I went and applied for the job out at Davis. And I went and interviewed. And the day I interviewed, I got an interview. And the day I interviewed, they give me a job description. It was about as big as this book. And I was about 20 minutes early, and I read through the job description, and my mind said, well, you should just get in your car and leave. That's what you should do. You should get in your car and leave, because see, you can't do that. And there's an old lady down in L.A., her name's Dottie, and she says, you know, a lot of times all we can do is just get dressed and give them the best sober person we are today. And I figure, well, I'm already dressed, hell, might as well go. I'll just go give them the best sober I am today. You know, and I went in there, and it was the first time in my life I ever interviewed in front of five people. And I interviewed, and it was just before I turned 5 years sober, and they called me 3 days later and told me I got the job. You know, and they gave me... Thank you. Thanks. They gave me all the Grand Master keys to all the buildings. I still have them. I still think that's funny. When I got here, they wouldn't give me the key to the porta pot, but things change, right? And I went on, and my life is, you know, it's gradually changing, and it's being involved with alcoholics and hanging out with new people and taking people to meetings and being involved and, you know, doing the things you don't want to do because you'd rather rent a video. You know what I'm saying? How many of you just rather rent a video, right? And the bottom line is that your life will change if you're willing to take the steps to change it. You know, I went to an Indian conference over in and I'm going to say this and I'll sit down because it's about 9:30 and you all look like you're about ready to go. Because I'm about running out of things to say. There's a lot I'd like to say, but I want to tell you about, first of all, I want to tell you about recently. It was about 18 months ago, I went for a job interview. And it was one of those jobs, it was at the university, it was one of those jobs for, it's a development team position, to be hired as on a development team. And, you know, part of me said, no, you know, you'd never get that job, but I went and applied anyhow, you know. And I went into a big fancy room with, interviewed, and this time I interviewed with 10 people. And it was one of those kinds where they had all those three-piece suits and their reflection was in the you know how, real nice, real fancy. I walked in the door and immediately who I brought to that room was that little half-breed Mexican nobody ever wanted. But what I've learned how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous kind of put her in the back. And I interviewed, and toward the end of the interview, it was a very long interview, they asked some very, 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 very strange questions. Well, one of the last questions they asked me, and I feel so proud of how I answered them. They looked at me and they said, you know, now that you're going to be working in management, and this position is in management, we'd like to know, what is it you do in your community that really gives back to the community you live in? Oh, jeez. And could you please tell us of a time or something that you've done? And I thought, well, I can't tell them about Alcoholics Anonymous. And then that part of my mind said, boy, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, you wouldn't be sitting here. Right? So I looked at him and I said, you know, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm kind of afraid telling you that, because I don't know what you're going to make that mean, and I don't know what you're going to do with that. But the bottom line, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here. And one of the most memorable nights I ever had in my whole life that I really think I contributed to my community in more than one way was I was a woman. I was one of the first women that ever went into the prison at San Quentin and did H&I meetings in San Quentin. You have to sign a no-disclosure statement to get in the door. That means that they may want to keep you and they don't want to do any trading. And I walked in there and I chaired a meeting in San Quentin, and those men, and I looked across the bay and from that low-income housing where I came from, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could hardly read or write. I could hardly read or write. And I talked about that night, and I had men come up to me, tell me they grew up in the same neighborhood that I did, and that if I could get sober, maybe they could. And I told that panel about that night, and I said, you know what? I'm proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know what you're going to do with this information. You might not even give me this job. But you know what? That's okay, too. They called me 4 days later, and they gave me that job. That's where you really trust in God. When they say, how do you trust in God? I want you to know in that moment I trusted in God. You know, I had to re-interview for that job because now it's not a development team job. It's a real job now, and been doing it for 18 months, but now I had to re-interview. That's how the state does things. I don't know why they do that, but I interviewed on the 1st of November, and I still don't know if I've got that job. They say I got a second interview to go to. That state just spends a lot of time interviewing people. But I want you to know it took a lot of courage just to show up to those damn interviews, and if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have the courage to show up. And the third, on the very favorite page of mine is on 312 on the page. It's called the last page of the Keys of the Kingdom. And it's my very, 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 it's just my best favorite page. You know, I went to this Indian conference over in Las Vegas a few years back, and I had the privilege and the honor of sharing a talking circle with an old Indian man who was 15 years sober, and he is 93 years old. That's commitment. You know, and he talked about, you know, as young people, he says, you know, as young people, you want to go to faraway places, and you want to take, you know, all those fancy trips. He goes, it's important that you take the trips, and when you're on those trips, that you pick up the soil for wherever you visit. You pick up the soil. And you smell the soil, and you touch the vegetation. And he says, and when you get home, you look at where you live. Learn the land that you live in. And he says, but I want you to know the longest journey you'll ever take will be from your mind to your heart. You know, and I was so moved by that. And then he went on to say a story about when he was on the reservation in the tribe that he comes from, that you couldn't speak to the medicine man until your head was the height of his shoulder. And the medicine man always carried rocks wherever he went. He had these rocks. When he was a young brave, he just knew those rocks had magic to them. He just knew it. And when he was old enough, he walked up to the old medicine man, and he goes, old man, what do you do with those rocks? He said, why, son, I'm just moving that mountain, one rock at a time. And he said that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are days that we have rocks we can't move, and what people do for us in Alcoholics Anonymous is they move our rocks, and we can't move our rocks. And there are days that I don't think I can move a pebble, and there are many people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are right there to help me move my rocks. And it said that we were powerless over alcohol, and the we means that we do it together. I want you to know that tonight has been a really special night for me. It's been an honor, and it's been a privilege. And I'd like everybody to hold hands, because it's something I just love to do now and then. I want you to take the hand of the person, because, you know, like, we get to carry each other's rocks, right? And the bottom line is, if you've thought about drinking recently and didn't, squeeze that person's hand. Right? If you thought about getting mad and leaving your relationship and you squeeze that person's hand, you know. Right? You thought about killing your boss, you know. And what we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you're new, what I want you to know that you're holding the gift of sobriety, because what we have is we have each other. And that's not a gift any people have. So I want to thank you for the honor and the privilege to be able to share my life with you, and that I made that journey from my mind to my heart tonight. Thank you.